between Palestine and Israel as the key to stability and prosperity in the enlarged Mediterranean. Max Civili, Rome.
People in the port city of Karachi hit the streets to voice their outrage at the ouster of the elected government. The protesters say the US conspired against their country. While Imran Khan never sought sore ties with any nation during his short-lived premiership.
Former Prime Minister Imran Khan has accused Biden administration in Washington for toppling his government in Pakistan, for not towing US's line on foreign policy.
Khan said that his life is in danger, but he prioritizes Pakistan's independence over his life.
Imran Khan had twice tweeted, or in fact more, but he had a clear clear message for the US administration that we are partners in peace. We will always be partners in peace. We are partners in trade. We'll always be partners in trade with the whole world, with everybody. But we will not take dictation from anybody.
I'm here specifically to do my part in wanting and executing the Pakistan that we all want. And I think Imran Khan represents a vision of that Pakistan. And I personally, honestly think it's not his job alone to do this. It's our job, our responsibility to come out and do this for ourselves. That's why I'm here.
We've gathered here because of the sovereignty of Pakistan, and we want Pakistan to get justice and Imran Khan to get justice, and we don't believe in the fake government.
Khan says US diplomats started meeting some Pakistani officials 4 months ago, adding that Pakistan's ambassador to the US was threatened.
We've gathered here to fight for a more democratic Pakistan, to fight for a free and independent Pakistan, to fight for a Pakistan that doesn't get bullied. That is our main reason for being here, for standing up for Pakistan, its sovereignty, and its integrity.
We're just here to support Imran Khan in this freedom fight. We are here to just, we don't accept the imported government. We're here to support our Prime Minister Imran Khan. He came here with the elected votes, our votes.
It's a protest for democracy. It's a protest for justice and for rights and human rights. The world, people choose their own leaders. Every citizen has a choice, has a right to choose their own people who they want to govern over them.
Khan has called for a snap election and urged an investigation into what he calls the US's plot to topple his government. He has become the first Pakistani prime minister to be removed from office through a non-confidence vote by the parliament. Mohammad Turi, Karachi.
Palestinians rallied in the besieged Gaza Strip on Sunday to mark the 48th anniversary of Palestinian Prisoners' Day. Palestinian Prisoners' Day commemorates the first Palestinian prisoner exchange deal with Tel Aviv in 1974. Statistics show that Israeli forces have arrested nearly 1 million Palestinians since 1967. The rally was organized by all Palestinian factions who came together to express their solidarity with the prisoners in Israeli jails.
On Palestinian Prisoners' Day, we call on all international organizations, especially the Red Cross, to fulfill their obligations towards Palestinian prisoners. The Red Cross has failed to protect Palestinian prisoners and has remained silent while Palestinian prisoners continue to suffer inside Zionist jails.
Israel currently holds around 5,000 Palestinians in its prisons and detention centers, including women and minors. Protesters shouted slogans against Israel and expressed their unwavering support for the prisoners.
For us, every day is a prisoner's day because Palestinian prisoners are our heroes and they live in our hearts and minds. We pray for them, especially during this holy month of Ramadan, to remain strong in the face of their Zionist captors.
Palestinian prisoners have gone on hunger strike several times in recent years to draw attention to their plight. Activists called on Palestinian armed wings to capture more Israeli soldiers in order to swap them with Palestinian prisoners.
Only capturing more Israeli soldiers can bring about the liberation of Palestinian prisoners. Armed resistance is the best option to help secure the release of the prisoners because our enemies only understand the language of force.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, Palestinian prisoners continue to face a wide range of human rights violations in Israeli jails and detention centers. as they mark Palestinian Prisoner Day, people here accuse the international community of turning a blind eye to the continued Israeli crimes against thousands of Palestinian prisoners. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The French presidential election was trending as an easy victory for the incumbent, Emmanuel Macron, until the unrest in Ukraine began. Macron's insistence on long-term sanctions for Russia exploded already high inflation. That's resulted in widespread hardship, resentment, and tough assessments of Macron's economic record.
It's clear that Macron has not improved the quality of life for the French. He's not responsible for all the problems he's had to deal with, but it's clear there's a big difference between what he's promised and what he's delivered.
The French election may come down to this. Who do voters feel will protect the average person from the economically explosive effect of long-term sanctions on Russia over the unrest in the Ukraine? It's not a question the mainstream media wants to discuss, but it is top of mind for the average person. Polls show the race is now a dead heat, with a soaring Marine Le Pen of the National Rally taking an opposite tack, promising to oppose Russia energy sanctions, which are wreaking havoc with gas, heating, and food prices. As the challenger, Le Pen doesn't have a record to defend, and she's escaping anger over the economic crisis.
Macron has absolutely not done a good job on protecting our purchasing power. The middle class feels that Macron has contempt for the middle class, and they also feel a great contempt for the neoliberal globalist banker Macron.
Macron's far-right economic policies provoked the unprecedented Yellow Vest protests in 2018. He only made minor concessions before turning to brutal repression, and the coronavirus crisis only aggravated economic inequalities.
Macron needed to go much further in his efforts to reduce prices. It's unbearable to go to the supermarket these days. Even people who make an honest salary say that they are having trouble.
Abstention may reach record highs because many voters wonder if Le Pen would actually deliver on her populist economic promises. Her party has historically been aligned with neoliberalism as well. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
Ramadan 2022 is underway, and Muslims are fasting from dawn to dusk. But to those who are fasting for the first time, it is going to be the most different and memorable Ramadan. Tehran municipality has invited more than 800 first-time fasters to this iftar meal to celebrate their religious coming of age. In Islam, a person would be responsible to perform their religious tasks when they reach puberty. And that's when they're duty-bound to fast during Ramadan.
We invited 850 kids today to teach them that fasting is more than a duty, but a bliss. Here, they learn about the benefits of fasting when it comes to regulating their digestive system. And more importantly, they learn that fasting polishes their soul as it boosts their spirituality.
In Muslim societies, Ramadan is known as the month of God, and Muslims believe they're invited to a divine party. That's why in the holy month, humanitarian activities and charity works get supercharged, with people trying to do whatever they can to help the needy.
Muslims view Ramadan as not just a time to refrain from eating and drinking. They regard it as a chance to push the limits on humanity and become the best version of yourself as a human being. And that's what organizers here try to teach first-time fasters. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Tensions are high in the occupied territories amid a recent increase in crackdown on Palestinians. Regime forces attacked worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque on Friday. Scores of Palestinians were wounded in the clashes. Around 400 people were also arrested. Muslim nations as well as resistance groups have condemned Tel Aviv. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation called on the international community to force Israel to end its aggression. Iran said Friday's events in Muslims' third holiest site show that the Palestinian resistance is alive and thriving, and Israel is in a state of desperation. Analysts believe that Tel Aviv is intentionally increasing tensions to take control of Al-Aqsa Mosque.
We think that the Israel are escalating the whole situation in the West Bank in order, at least in Jerusalem, in order to control the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And that was the aim for the settlers groups who announced many times that they wanted, to get into Al-Aqsa Mosque and practice some of their own religion kind of practices. If they did such an act, definitely that would lead to a war.
The clashes came after 3 weeks of deadly tensions in the occupied territories. Tel Aviv has deployed more forces to the West Bank and conducted raids and house searches there almost every day. This has resulted in the deaths and injuries of dozens of Palestinians. Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has given Israeli forces a free hand in their operations. Many believe that the latest escalation could turn into an uprising or a new intifada in Palestine.
Palestinian experts are warning that they could return back, let's say, to more clashes, more escalation. These killings by the Israeli forces and this escalation could any time turn into an uprising or an intifada. No one can tell, especially that the Israelis are saying they will not end their operation. It will continue.
Palestinians have also increased their operations in response to the crackdown. Since March 22nd, they have conducted several stabbing and shooting operations, including one in Tel Aviv, leaving 14 Israelis dead. The increase in anti-Israel operations in the occupied territories show that Palestinians have reached a conclusion that they should decide their own fate, especially after several Arab countries normalized ties with Israel. Palestinians believe that resistance against occupation is the only way they have to achieve their goals.
People in the besieged Gaza Strip held a rally following the Friday prayers to express their solidarity with Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Angry protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowing to sacrifice their lives for the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Earlier, the Israeli regime forces stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Old City of Al-Quds, injuring more than 150 worshippers during the second Friday of the fasting holy month of Ramadan. Hamas movement has warned the Israeli regime against violations at Al-Aqsa Mosque.
We are prepared to wage wars for the sake of Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will continue to the equation of arms for arms and blood for blood, and that Al-Quds is a red line that must not be crossed. The Israeli occupation will bear for responsibility for any repercussions as a result of its attacks against the worshippers. We are ready for all scenarios to stop this enemy and protect our people.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vow to increase their solidarity with Al-Quds until the removal of all Israeli violations in the holy city.
The Palestinian people are united for the sake of Al-Quds, and we will not abandon Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will fight for the sake of Al-Quds and sacrifice our lives for it.
The Israeli regime has stepped up its deadly acts of aggression in Al-Quds since the beginning of Ramadan. Palestinian resistance factions warned the Israeli regime of dire consequences if Israeli forces continue to attack Al-Quds.
The Israeli is sending a clear message to the Zionist enemy that it must understand that we will not sit idle while it attacks Al-Quds. The Zionist enemy is playing with fire and it will only explode in its face.
The Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islam's third holiest site and has been under Israeli occupation since 1967.
Palestinians in the besieged coastal enclave say that they will use all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Heavy stumps of marching soldiers and convoys of Iranian-made weapons paraded in Tehran and across the country on the National Army Day. All of the four branches of the military took part in the key parade, held at the presence of army officials and Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi. Addressing the ceremony, the president hailed the army's achievements despite the U.S. sanctions.
The defense industry fared the best amid the sanctions atmosphere. The Islamic Republic's army achieved significant capabilities during this period. Not only did the army defend the nation during the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran, but it has stood with the people and for the people in all areas.
The parade featured the latest military achievements and weapons produced by the Iranian army, including radars, tanks, armored vehicles, drones, fighter jets, and missiles. This year's highlights were FAT-360 surface-to-surface missile, Labeg precision strike rockets, and Dezful and Majid air defense systems. The Islamic Republic says it produces over 80% of its needed military hardware indigenously. In his address to the parade, the Iranian president said the country's show of power sends messages both to friends and enemies.
The preparedness of the army sends the message of hope to the friends of the Islamic Republic. There's also a message to the enemy. The enemy must know that the military might of our armed forces gives us a deterrent power. They must know that the smallest move made against our country and our nation would be monitored by the sharp eyes of our armed forces.
The National Army Day was designated in 1980, following a historic speech by late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. There, he thanked the army for its role in the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution by announcing neutrality in the conflict between the former Pahlavi regime and their revolutionaries.
4 decades of arms embargoes have denied Iran access to even a bullet from other countries. The army says the parades today show that those bans have not harmed Iran's military capability. But in fact, they've been a blessing, since they prompted Iran to build up its own military arsenal so that its security is no longer tied to foreign arms. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
With U.S. President Joe Biden's sagging approval ratings, Democrats' agenda stalled, public discontent over the economy and inflation, and Republicans' strong performance in a series of off-cycle elections, the political landscape in the United States looks grim for the Democratic Party. We now present you an article written by Lauren Gambino. The piece is titled, Wave of U.S. House Democratic Retirement Stokes Fear for Party's Election Prospects. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. For the Michigan Congresswoman Brenda Lawrence, it was a question from her husband, when is our time? For the North Carolina Congressman, David Price, it was a judgment that the time has come to step down. Some retiring U.S. Democrats have blamed the gridlock and dysfunction on Capitol Hill, while others point to the redrawing of congressional maps. Still others cite the rise of political extremism and the deteriorating relations between members of Congress, particularly in the wake of 6th of January 2021 insurrection. Announcing his decision to retire last year, the Wisconsin congressman, Ron Kind, was frank. "The truth is, I've run out of gas," he said. The decision not to seek re-election is both deeply personal and political. But as the party braces for a grueling midterm election this November, a rising number of House Democrats are opting not to return to Congress next year. On Monday, the Florida congressman Ted Deutch announced that he would not seek re-election, bringing the total number of Democratic departures from the House of Representatives so far this cycle to 31. Among them, 8 Democrats are seeking other offices next year, like Tim Ryan of Ohio, who's running for the Senate, and Karen Bass of California, who's running to be mayor of Los Angeles. Some retiring members are powerful veterans, such as Kentucky's John Yarmuth, chair of the Budget Committee, and Oregon's Peter DeFazio, chair of the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. Others represent politically competitive districts, like Stephanie Murphy of Florida and Ann Kirkpatrick of Arizona. It's a worrying trend for Democrats. Congressional retirements are often an early sign of a wave election for the other party. In 2018, dozens of House Republicans did not seek re-election, including the then House Majority Leader Paul Ryan. The Republican Party lost 41 seats that year, and Democrats gained control of the chamber in an election cycle widely viewed as a referendum on Donald Trump. This year, the political winds are reversed. Republicans are trumpeting each retirement as a sign that Democrats' hopes of keeping their majority are fading. The National Republican Congressional Committee, the NRCC spokesman Mike Berg, said their majority is doomed. Either retire or lose. Though many vacancies are in safely Democratic districts, the rush of retirements among Democrats comes as the party faces significant historical headwinds. The president's party almost always loses seats in the midterm elections, and in the House of Representatives, Democrats can only afford to lose a handful of seats before surrendering control of the House. With Joe Biden's sagging approval ratings, Democrats' agenda stalled, public discontent over the economy and rising inflation, and Republicans' strong performance in a series of off-cycle elections, the political landscape looks grim for the Democratic Party. Adding to the uncertainty is a once-in-a-decade redistricting process when a state's congressional and legislative districts are redrawn. The House of Representatives is often a reflection of the national American mood, which public opinion shows is pessimistic. Voters are frustrated with their political leaders, and the Democratic Party is bracing for a backlash. In polling that asked voters which party they would support on Election Day as opposed to which congressional candidate, Republicans repeatedly hold the edge. In an interview, Price, an 81-year-old, said his decision to leave Congress after 3 decades was mainly personal and not circumstantial. During the Trump years, he said many long-serving Democrats postponed the decision to retire because they believed their experience was needed on Capitol Hill. Now they feel the time is right to retire. Price's new district is rated safely Democratic, and after a long redistricting battle, the North Carolina State Supreme Court recently approved congressional maps that are favorable to the Democratic Party. Kyle Condick, the managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics, said, The number of retirements is naturally higher in years that end in two because those are redistricting cycles. It's been a brutal experience for some. Congressman Jim Cooper witnessed his reliable Democratic Nashville seat being carved up into three different districts that Donald Trump would have easily won in 2020. He decried the move as raw politics and an effort to dilute the electoral power of black voters. A day after the Tennessee legislature approved the map, Congressman Jim Cooper announced his retirement from Congress, where he had served for more than three decades. He said, "I explored every possible way, including lawsuits, to stop the gerrymandering and to win one of the three new congressional districts that now divide Nashville." He added, "There's no way, at least for me in this election cycle, but there may be a path for other worthy candidates." John Rogers, a Republican pollster who was the executive director of the National Republican Congressional Committee during the 2018 midterm election cycle, says the retirements of powerful and long-serving Democrats is a strong sign that the Democratic Party is bracing for defeat this November. John Rogers added, "There are too many committee chairs retiring for this to be just about redistricting," adding that the prospect of losing a gavel or ending a lengthy career in the minority was unattractive to some politicians. Retirements deprive a party of the advantages that come with incumbency: fundraising, name recognition, and a deep understanding of their constituency, factors that are especially critical in competitive seats. Kondik, author of The Long Red Thread, How Democratic Dominance Gave Way to Republican Advantage in U.S. House Elections, said, "Incumbency is not as valuable as it used to be, but open seats are generally harder to defend, particularly in a wave-style environment." Not since 1992 have so many House Democrats opted not to seek re-election. And with states still finalizing their congressional maps and candidate filing deadlines approaching, there might be more retirements to come. Kondik said, "However bad it is to serve in Congress, it's worse to serve in the minority, particularly in the House." Notably bucking the trend, the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has announced her decision to run again, extinguishing speculation that she would retire at the end of the term. Nancy Pelosi was re-elected as Speaker of the House after agreeing to step down from the role by the end of 2022. The Republican retirements, though far fewer, are also telling. As of this week, 15 House Republicans have said they won't run for re-election, with 7 running for another office. Among them are more moderate members, including Adam Kinzinger of Illinois and John Katko of New York, who have faced conservative backlash for voting to impeach former President Donald Trump. Democrats argue that much could change before the November elections. The COVID-19 pandemic appears to be in retreat, and officials claim the economy remains strong despite inflation. Joe Biden has started to ramp up his travel around the country, touting his legislative accomplishments. He has received rare bipartisan praise from his handling of the crisis in Ukraine, and Democratic voters are excited about his nominee for the Supreme Court, Ketanji Brown Jackson, who is poised to become the first black woman to serve on the Supreme Court bench after a confirmation hearings later this month. And Republicans, they say, will have to answer for Donald Trump's enduring control over their party and the fallout from the congressional investigation into the events of 6th of January 2021, as well as for their efforts to restrict access to abortion and the ballot, issues that Democrats believe will rally voters to their side this cycle. Ian Russell, a Democratic strategist and former national political director with the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, said, "Most midterm elections, by their nature, are referenda on a party of power." But he said that by embracing Donald Trump's lies about election fraud and refusing to sanction their most extreme members, Republicans are helping frame the election as a choice between two parties with very different priorities, only one of which is going to wind up in charge. Last month, Lawrence, the Michigan congresswoman, surprised some of her colleagues when she announced that she would retire at the end of the term, after more than three decades in public service. She said in an interview, after 4 years of Donald Trump's administration, the COVID-19 pandemic, 6th of January, it was a death by a million cuts. Lawrence, who represents a heavily Democratic district and is the only black member of Michigan's congressional delegation, said she feels good about her legacy and would continue to be active in her community in other ways. "I'm not going home to plant flowers," she said. She hopes her departure will make room for a new generation of black lawmakers who will bring fresh urgency to the battles over women's reproductive rights, voting protections, and police reform. She said, "I came into Congress when we were in the minority, but I came in with the intent to make a difference, and I hope that continues to motivate American citizens to step up into public service, because there is work to do."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hanan was on her way home when she was wounded by Israeli fire during a raid on the Jenin refugee camp just a few days ago. Since weeks ago, Israeli forces have been attacking the Palestinian refugee camp in Jenin, as well as other cities in the West Bank. The situation has recently been tense in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, with Israeli forces and settlers storming the Al-Aqsa Mosque. At least 170 Palestinians have been injured in the attacks, and that happened on Friday alone. Why is this happening, and what's in the offing? Further escalation or de-escalation? Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let's see who's joining us in this episode of The Spotlight. Author, researcher, and analyst Daniel Kovalik out of Pittsburgh. Also with us will be writer and activist Laith Maarouf, who's joining us from Montreal. Now, let me turn to Pittsburgh first. Daniel, let's begin with the reason or the reasons behind this recent escalation and violence in Palestinian territories. You know, there are some who believe that the Zionists are trying to sort of provoke the Palestinians. Do you agree with them, and why should they do that?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. First of all, we have to, you know, keep in mind this is happening during the holy week of Ramadan.
Months of Ramadan, yeah.
In addition, it happened, you know, began during, you know, the holy day of Passover for Jews. So, you know, it was a significant time that this all began. And clearly it was done to provoke a response by the Palestinians. I agree. I think especially with the war in Ukraine and attention to fix there, I think the Israelis think that this is a good time to provoke the Palestinians, and then they would feel justified in launching a bigger attack in the West Bank, and apparently Gaza too, because Israel has also been bombing Gaza in the last day or so. So yeah, it's very clear that that's what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Now over to Montreal. There are some people who argue that the Zionist aggression against the Palestinians is pre-planned. So what goal are they trying to achieve, and would they succeed to do that?
Let's be very frank here. The Zionists have lost their mind. They're lunatics right now. Because if you do any strategic analysis of the battlefield right now in Western Asia, you would understand that is not the time for Israel to be flexing its muscles as the United States is withdrawing from the region, as the other vessels of the United States are trying to wind down their confrontations. So to see the Zionists do what they did just now is to understand that they can't help themselves. They can't stop themselves from acting in such lunatic manner. Everybody knows attempting to slaughter some animals on the inside the Aqsa Mosque and performing some cultist religious sacrifice there will lead to confrontation, and the Palestinians will fight it back. That's what happened last year. So why do it this year if you're not a crazy lunatic who lost your mind? And that's what the situation is for the Zionist colony. They're like a chicken without a head right now, taking, flopping left and right, and the axis of resistance and the Palestinians should be ready for the consequences of the lunatic behavior of the Zionists. Mm-hmm.
Now, Daniel, in response to the latest atrocities by the Tel Aviv regime, Hamas is saying that the regime will not be able to undermine the Palestinians' struggle for their legitimate rights. Could this violence weaken Palestinian resolve, or will it just backfire?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I don't know for sure. Certainly, look, the Palestinians are a brave people. They have tremendous resolve. The Israelis will not break their resolve. But they could provoke a response that again, the Israelis will use as a pretext for maybe an invasion into the territories. And could the Palestinians, you know, withstand that and beat that back? I'm not sure, you know. And I am concerned that with the world's attention on Ukraine right now, that Israel probably could get away with more than they could otherwise. So we'll have to see. I mean, Israel certainly, from a military point of view, has the upper hand vis-a-vis the Palestinians, who've been, you know, sadly abandoned by the world for the most part, certainly by the Gulf states in the Middle East, certainly by Europe. And, you know, so we'll see. They obviously have some allies in the region, like Iran and Hezbollah, who would, you know, possibly come to their defense. So we'll have to see.
Mm-hmm. Now, Laith, Daniel mentioned the war in Ukraine. And now we have this double standard, if you agree, that's practiced by Western media. They're doing, you know, this wall-to-wall coverage of the war in Ukraine since day one. But they don't talk much about the Palestinians and the plight and the situation they're suffering from.
Look, for us living in the South and East, peoples that are requesting decolonization, we shouldn't care really what the Western media says. And we already know that our lives are irrelevant to the core elite in the empire. So putting that on the side, I just want to say that usually I would never disagree with our colleague Daniel here. I find myself disagreeing here in this point because the Zionists right now are at their weakest point since the creation of the colony. And in fact, today, just a few hours ago, they were attacking Gaza, and for the first time ever, the Palestinian resistance in Gaza used anti-air defenses and chased out the Zionist Air Force. So what we see is the last time the Zionists attacked Gaza, they couldn't last 11 days. They couldn't last 11 days.
Right.
And in a conflict that's going to roll out right now, this could bring the end of the Zionist colony.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, what do you think? Why shouldn't Western media care about Palestinians and things, happening to them, but giving preferential treatment to Ukraine and elsewhere?
Well, obviously, there's a couple reasons for that. One, overt racism. Let's face it, a lot of people have talked about that in the West, they care more about Ukrainians who have blonde hair and blue eyes than they do about other people suffering war and atrocities in the war, like the Palestinians, like the people in Yemen, for example. But also, of course, it's common for everyone in the world, but certainly we know the West, to focus on the crimes of others rather than their own crimes, right? It's easier to point a finger at Russia and Vladimir Putin than to look at ourselves, at our own allies like Israel, and look at the, crimes that they're committing. And so for both of those reasons, the West has turned away from the Palestinians in a big way. And by the way, I'll just, in response to my colleague, I would just want to say I truly hope that he's right, that the Palestinians, have the power to defend themselves and to defend their territory and, to end this apartheid system in Israel.
Mm-hmm. Now, Laith, we talked about the Western media coverage, actual lack of coverage or blackout when it comes to Palestinians, Yemenis, and other people. So what about the international community? Are they not informed about what the Palestinians are going through, and or have they opted to ignore all of that?
I think obviously the word international community is a euphemism of white-centered societies. And there is no such thing as an international community. There is colonial powers and countries that are attempting to decolonize and reach sovereignty and liberation. And, excuse me, this means that honestly, after what we just saw in Ukraine, and we keep on talking about Ukraine, there is no point of crying on the shoulder of your colonizer. You have to achieve decolonization through your brute force and then enforce your view of the world and on your enemy. And until then, as long as there is not yet a total defeat of the colonial powers in the Arabic world, they will continue to look down and demonize and dehumanize and defame Arabs and Muslims in general until we have a power center that can stand up to them and make sure that our peoples are not denigrated.
Mm-hmm. Now, Daniel, let's take a look at how far the U.S.'s schemes and its staunch support for the Tel Aviv regime has been responsible for the situation that we're witnessing in the occupied lands these days.
Yeah, well, the U.S., of course, bears a huge responsibility for what's happening. Israel is more or less, an outpost of the U.S. In the region. The U.S. blindly supports Israel to the tune of over $3 billion a year. Which props up the Israeli military. I don't see a lot of signs that that's going to end anytime soon. There's very few people in Congress who ever criticize Israel. When they do, of course, they're attacked as anti-Semitic, even if they happen to be Palestinian themselves, right? But yeah, the U.S. bears a huge responsibility. And that's why, it is important, the solidarity movement in countries like the United States, the BDS movement. I think they can play an important role in helping, at least aiding the struggle of the Palestinian people. And I see that as an emerging and growing movement in the United States. And I hope that that continues to grow.
Now, Laith, do you find Washington complicit in the crimes that the Israelis are committing against Palestinians?
For sure. I mean, 100%. The Zionist colony cannot exist without direct military intervention of the United States and direct siphoning of resources to the Zionist colony. Even its economy is a fabricated economy. People keep on, you know, the Zionists keep on bragging about the prowess of their technology sector. That sector wouldn't exist if there is no direct, unnatural investment from the West into the Zionist colony. So, yes, this is just a beachhead, a military base, you know, at the heart of the Arabic world, at the heart of the Muslim world, that chops off geographically the continuity of our peoples and continues to act as a poisonous pouch, spitting out poison every time the region starts destabilizing and our peoples begin to build our capabilities. You know, this colony causes strife in the region.
Mm-hmm. And Daniel, what is it that keeps whoever is at the White House, no matter who takes the helm of the White House, to continue to do the same thing, to the way that the U.S. has been acting regarding Palestinians? We had President Trump going there and, you know, he would publicly announce what he, you know, he was wearing his heart on his sleeves, and he would just let you know what he feels about Palestinians and Israelis. He gave Israelis open support. They, you know, there was this hill they named after him, the occupied ones in Golden Heights, the Trump Hill and that. And then he offered the so-called deal of the century, which Palestinians find to stab in the back. And he sounded the way, you know, but President Trump doesn't sound like him, but not much has changed under this new administration. And God knows who the next person will be, but why doesn't things change for Palestinians?
Well, again, there's several reasons for that. I think the power of the Israeli lobbying in the United States is incredible with AIPAC. There's a lot of money that's given to both parties by AIPAC to keep supporting Israel. You know, you see Israel sponsors all these trips for freshman Congress people to go over to Israel. And so you have that sort of lobbying and pressure and money. I think also there's just this almost instinctive feeling that somehow Israel is the essential ally for the United States in the world, that it will never abandon, even though I think there's a lot of arguments to be made that Israel has, you know, if it was ever a real help to the U.S., it's become an incredible liability. And, you know, to me, it's inexplicable is in terms of what it's actually accomplishing for the U.S. Mm-hmm. In the region. I think all it does is create more instability, more hatred towards the United States, and of course it costs the U.S. a lot of money. So there's a good case to be made that it makes no sense to keep propping up Israel. But again, it's almost a dogma that is inviolable in the United States, that somehow we have to support Israel. And again, those who speak out against that notion are attacked.
Right. Now, Laith, let's take a look at the Arab states, a number of Arab states, so-called normalization deals they signed with Tel Aviv. How far have those deals emboldened the regime to push ahead with atrocities against Palestinians?
It added to their delusion, because the reality is that these vassal Arab monarchies that never experienced the revolutions of decolonization after the end of World War II, which were protected by the French, the English, and the Americans after, have always been on the side of the Zionists. They've never actually helped the Palestinian people. So in reality, what they just did with this is they exposed their vassals and are weakening the vassal states in the Gulf, this action of normalization in public. I want to add also that, the existence of the Zionist colony is maybe at the heart of the imperialist project. Without the existence of the Zionist colony, the United States will not be able to project its power to all of Asia, North Africa, and East Africa, the Horn, which means it cannot control the world. you know, no matter what you try, it's not really about the power of the Zionist lobby. It's an issue of survival of the United States, the existence of the Zionist colony. And they will die. They, you know, it will be the last thing they will let go of as an imperial power. And therefore, what the Palestinians are doing as work of liberation of Palestine is liberation work for all of the world. The United States will cease to be able to project its power into right. Asia and Africa without the existence of this colony.
Mm-hmm. Now, Daniel, given the circumstances and the occupied territories, you know, this land grab policy is being perpetuated, more Palestinian land is being, you know, confiscated, settlements are being built on top of them, then we also have this violence against them, and also then we have the silence and inaction of international organizations and bodies. So what is the right way for the Palestinians under such conditions?
The right way to defend themselves? I mean, I agree with my colleague that in the end, they're going to have to defend their rights by force. I mean, no one is standing up for them. No one is defending their right of return. No one is defending their right to exist. No one is defending, you know, the international consensus that these settlements in the West Bank are illegal. Nothing is done to change that situation. The settlements continue, in fact, increase. And so really, in the end, it is up to the Palestinian people to fight and defend their rights. I don't see any other way. You know, there was a time when some of us thought maybe nonviolence was the way, but I don't think that only works when you have an enemy that is moral, right? And that you can influence their moral compunctions, right? And I don't see that here. I don't see Israel having that. I don't see the U.S. having that. And lacking that, I think all they can do is have a defense of armed force.
Okay. And Jalaith, what's the way for them forward? I mean, is it, let's say, mediation by third parties, deal of the century? Is it resistance? What's the best way forward?
I mean, obviously, that has been tried, tested, and so anybody that currently will speak about negotiated end of hostilities is living in the past century. In this 21st century right now, the only way forward for the Palestinians is armed struggle, and at the same time to offer the Zionists the same offer that Salah ad-Din gave to the Crusaders, which is you have the right to stay in your home, shut in, and become an equal to the indigenous population of Palestine. You have the right to loot what you want and get on a boat and leave and nobody will get in your way, or you have the right to die by the sword fighting as a colonizer. And this is the offer that should be given openly now by the Palestinian resistance to the Zionists.
Okay. On that note, we come to the end of this edition.